From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm John McKay, in for Chris Boyd. What happens when a country's former monarch betrays his or her nation? Marshaling the evidence to prove the charge beyond all doubt takes years. But in the book Traitor King, The Scandalous Exile of the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, British historian Andrew Lowney makes the case against the late Edward VIII of England, who gave up the throne to marry the love of his life and then joined her in working against his nation and in the interests of Adolf Hitler while war raged between the two countries. Andrew Lowney joins us from the United Kingdom. Welcome to Think.
Very nice to be with you.
It isn't any exaggeration to call Edward and Wallace the most talked about couple, not just in England, but in the Western world at the time all this was going on.
Yes, I mean, they were, I suppose, the first celebrity couple. Everyone thought it was a great love story. They regularly topped lists of best-dressed people, and thousands turned out to see them, particularly in Baltimore, her home city.
You know, even before he met Wallace Simpson, Edward was the true source of media attention, the celebrity bachelor king.
Yes, he was. I mean, he was very charismatic. He was being sent off to do a whole series of empire tours after the First World War, which brought him to the attention, really, of the world. He went right around the world, India, Australia, and all covered by Pathé News. So he was good looking, he was charming, and he was a sense that here was, you know, a modernizer compared to his father, George V. You know, he seemed like a breath of fresh air.
The public was fascinated by him, but it seems that the people who really knew him, so his family, particularly his father, his private secretary, they had some fairly unfavorable opinions of him.
Yes, there was a total disconnect between the public reputation, and this often happens with royals, and the private reality. His advisors and his family were really very concerned. They felt he had no sense of public duty. He just wanted to party the whole time. He wasn't very bright. No sense of public duty, and therefore also very keen to interfere in politics. And they could see that he, particularly by the early 30s, had very strong sympathies with the Nazi regime in Germany. And this worried them. So they encouraged him to take up all the most dangerous sports in the hope he would kill himself. But alas, he didn't. But good old Wallace came along and she saved the nation instead.
Yeah, you know, Edward, even at a young age, you're right, he had this attraction to Germany.
Yes, I mean, he spoke fluent German. He was 14th, 16th German. His mother was a German princess. He was very close to many of his German cousins, some of whom were Nazi generals. He regularly visited it. He liked dressing up in lederhosen and eating schnitzel. He was temperamentally more German than he was British. And I think this was the problem.
We make the mistake, I think you explain in the book, of thinking that this developed during the war. But in point of fact, as you point out, this is long before the war. These concerns are being raised. These concerns are privately being raised about him, particularly his father's concerns and that sort of thing.
Yes, I mean, his father put him under intelligence surveillance, equivalent of FBI, in 1935, which is pretty extraordinary. And that revealed not just his links, his dealings with German officials, but also the fact that while he was having this affair with Wallace, he was also having an affair with an Austrian princess. Wallace, incidentally, was having an affair with a British used car salesman at the same time. But when the Anglo-German naval agreement came along in 1935, he tried to interfere. And then when he became king in January 1936, the Germans thought they'd hit lucky. They, in fact, had sent an agent to take the next door apartment to Wallace in London to basically put pressure on her, because they thought through Wallace it was the easiest way to persuade him. But when it came to, for example, the remilitarization of the Rhineland in March 1936, he tried to downplay it. He tried to change government policy. And this was a great concern in both cabinet and in the civil service. He was taking his red boxes filled with secret documents home for the weekend to his weekend retreat, Fort Belvedere, leaving the boxes open. German intelligence agents were actually staying with him often. So he was a security risk as well as a political risk.
Yeah, most of us in the United States are unaware of the red box tradition, but that would be the king actually would have access to these top secret materials.
That's right. I mean, every night he would be given this red suitcase. It would have papers that he should see or should sign, and they included the most sensitive secret intelligence material. This stuff eventually was being withheld from him because of the concerns that it was getting back to the Germans. And this was even before he became king.
So in the briefings that I would imagine that as king, he gets these regular briefings. Does he hear that the government is concerned about Hitler in these briefings, but he still feels the way he feels?
Certainly, the civil service and his private advisors, secretaries, warned him about his association with some of these Germans. But he just ignored all advice, and he was to do so throughout his life. Throughout his life, intelligence officials would warn him about dealing with certain people who were known to be spies. And he just continued. He didn't care.
You know, the general view, I think, in this country, and we've talked about this a little bit, is that Edward was forced to leave because he wanted to marry Wallis Simpson. And we've gotten it just from what you've been saying so far. Really, there was a great interest in removing him long before his involvement with her.
Yes, I mean, I argue in the book that Wallis was a convenient device, that he was maneuvered off the throne, in effect, in a coup. There were lots of options for him. He could have delayed marriage to her after the coronation. He could have had her as a morganatic wife. He could have kept her as a mistress. But the government realized that she was his vulnerability. He was determined to marry her, in fact, threatened to kill himself if she wouldn't marry him. And they just realized that this was their way to get him off the throne. So having failed to do this through dangerous sports, they did it through an American divorcee.
You know, even as I think about this, even if Edward was a saint and Mrs. Simpson was Wallace Simpson was a saint, it still would have been a no-no, just what, based upon the fact that she's divorced?
Yes, I mean, that was certainly the ostensible reason. I mean, he was the supreme governor of the Church of England, i.e. the head of the Church of England. It didn't recognize divorce. I mean, divorces weren't allowed into the royal enclosure at Ascot horse races until quite recently. Of course, we had, you know, the great scandal when Princess Margaret wanted to marry the innocent party in the divorce, Group Captain Peter Townsend. So this was a real no-no. But they were very clever. Baldwin, the Prime Minister, sought the views of the most conservative part of the empire, Canada, and he utilized church opinion. So there were plenty of people who said that the king should fight. Churchill was a great supporter of his. He actually ran what's called the King's Party. So there were plenty of people who were prepared to put up a fight and argue his case. And as I say, there were other options for him if he wanted to keep her and the throne. So it wasn't a strict choice between one or the other, but he, in a sense, allowed himself to be maneuvered into a position where it became that.
You know, some of the real fears surrounding his involvement with Wallis Simpson was the fact that apparently she had intimate relations with the German ambassador to the United Kingdom, Joachim von Ribbentrop.
That's right. I mean, Ribbentrop was sent to Britain as British ambassador because he was close to Wallis. I've not found any evidence that they had a physical relationship, though it was said that they'd slept together 17 times, which is why he sent her 17 carnations a day. But they were certainly very close. I mean, she was always denying it, but, you know, they kept photos. She had a photo of him in her bathroom. There's several intelligence reports talking about her close connections with Ribbentrop. I think it's pretty clear that she was certainly very close to the Nazi leadership, as was he. They were both equally sympathetic to the Nazi regime.
So, you know, Hitler appointed von Ribbentrop at this position. You've said this, he's trying to get some kind of an alliance between an Anglo-German alliance that he believes is going to be necessary.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, in fact, there's some suggestion the previous German ambassador was murdered because he died very suddenly under very peculiar circumstances. And I think even the American ambassador in London writes in his diary about the rumour circulating. But absolutely, the two of them, Hitler didn't want to fight Britain. He saw them as part of the sort of Anglo-Saxon group of nations. He wanted to focus his energies on the communists and Russia. The king or prince, eventually Duke of Windsor, thought exactly the same. He was worried that this would lead to the end of the empire, which it did, and that the real threat was not fascism, but really communism. Indeed, many of the supporters of the king in Britain were fascists. On the night of the abdication, there were huge demonstrations by Oswald Mosley's Black Shirts. And many of the police reports are about monitoring these disturbances. And one of the reasons that they were very keen, the British, to get the Duke of Windsor out of Britain was that he was seen to be some sort of focus for these Black Shirts. And Oswald Mosley, who to the end of his life supported Hitler, remained a friend of the Duke of Windsor until the Duke's death.
You know, during all this time and afterward, the government and in fact the royal family, they really did all they could to try to keep them from getting married. There's something that's called the China dossier that was put together, I understand, to affect her reputation.
That's right. Wallace had spent a lot of time before she with her first husband, who was an American Air Force officer, in China. There were stories that circulated that she had actually been, in effect, a prostitute there at one point. But she'd certainly learned all sorts of sexual techniques, the most famous known as the Singapore grip. And it was always said that part of her appeal to the Duke, who had sexual problems, was her sexual techniques. Now, this China dossier, no one has ever, in a sense, produced. It was put together by the British intelligence services for the royal family. And of course, there's no reason why it should have gone public. It was a very secret and sensitive series of documents. But several people who are authoritative have referred to seeing it, including the private secretary to Queen Mary, the mother of the Duke of Windsor. So I'm pretty sure the China dossier existed. It wasn't really created as some sort of false flag operation. Certainly there was a lot of dirt on Wallace. And they were prepared to use it against her if required. The Duke himself was under surveillance, not just by MI5, the equivalent of the FBI, but also his private security detail, the special branch officers. And later he was under surveillance by the FBI, by the French Secret Service when he lived there, and by the Portuguese Secret Service when he was there during the war. So all the intelligence services were interested in him, and one has to wonder why were they interested in him unless there were real concerns about his loyalties.
You know, a lot of this comes from FBI records. Also, there's talk of an abandoned vehicle that was discovered at the very end of the war, and this vehicle is full of some German documents and I guess a microfilm that really didn't say any nice things about what Edward may have been up to.
No, I mean, we have plenty of evidence about his treachery. So reporting on this, a lot of the official material is basically what we call dry cleaned. It's basically been taken out of the files and you can't see it and it's destroyed. But there's plenty of evidence there. Now, the strongest evidence comes from what we call the Windsor or Marburg files. And these are indeed the files that were found buried in the forest near Marburg in Germany in the spring of 1945.
You know, we tend to think that Edward's love for Wallace and abdication, that was a major crisis. But you make the argument that really England was, the country was rescued from having to find a way to get rid of him because of these political beliefs.
Yes, I mean, I think there are lots of myths surrounding Wallace Simpson and the Duke of Windsor. One is that it was a great love affair. It wasn't. This was a woman trapped in a marriage that she didn't want, who had a succession of affairs throughout their marriage, who despised and was bored by this boy king. who was obsessed with her. And indeed, the more awful she was to him, and she often sent him to bed in tears, she told him to buzz off like a mosquito, the more she behaved like that, humiliating him, cuckolding him in public, the more he loved it and the more he loved her. But as you say, this was the abdication saved Britain and the monarchy. We moved from a king who was totally unsuitable, dissolute, irresponsible, much more interested in playing golf and gardening than doing any governing, and who would have done a deal with the Germans if they'd invaded Britain and he'd been king. We would probably have had jackboots up the Mall and concentration camps in Britain. With Jews sent to them. So we were saved by Wallace. There should be a statue to her here. And of course, that set us off on the new direction of the royal family of duty and service, exemplified by George VI and then, of course, by Elizabeth II. I mean, one of the interesting situations is we would now be celebrating not 70 years of the Queen, but 50 years of her reign. If the Duke had actually continued, he would have been there until 1972. But I think the fascinating thing is that we think we know the story, but actually when you start delving into the archives and documents, there's a completely different version that appears that's been hidden by the establishment.
Well, I was going to say, no one made it easy for you to get this material. This is what you write about is something that still a lot of people would love to just keep quiet and forget.
Yes, they would. And it's interesting that all my books have had extensive review coverage, but this one, at least initially, though it was a top 10 bestseller, had no coverage from the major papers, apart from a rave review from the TLS saying I'd made my case. But they were clearly the papers were being warned off not to review it. The comments from when comment was asked from Buckingham Palace and elsewhere was no comment. I've certainly had great difficulties in trying to access documents. For example, when documents are opened each year at the National Archives, historians are traditionally invited to look at them and write about them. And I used to do that every year as a journalist. I'm no longer invited. And one of the problems, I think, with royal biography is the people who tend to write it tend to be very sympathetic to the monarchy. They are reliant on getting basically their titbits from the press office. They don't want to upset the powers that be. And it's a nice, cozy arrangement. And so people like me who rely on documents and independent verification are really, they try and freeze us out because they don't like the real story being told.
You know, getting back to the period when Edward was king, did the government ever, realizing what was going on, did they begin to withhold sensitive state papers from him?
Yes. As I say, his red boxes got thinner and thinner. Mm-hmm. They just decided that it was too risky to put some of this stuff in the red box. And I think he realized this. He didn't go to some of the meetings that he might have gone. He certainly didn't get the briefings he should have got. He, in effect, is head of the intelligence services, and yet they were actually spying on him. And though I think those things tend to happen sometimes in the States, that was absolutely the first time it had happened and probably the last time it's happened in British history.
Was it difficult for the intelligence people to be convinced of what was going on with regard to Edward and what he might be doing? Was that, I mean, I can't imagine them if hearing some of these things, saying, okay, well, it's no problem, just let's just move on. But didn't it reach the point where they had to address this?
Well, the initial orders for surveillance came from the King George V in 1935, and they continued. And I think the people who pushed this were not really the intelligence services who were tasked to do this, but senior cabinet ministers, the Home Secretary, the Foreign Secretary, the head of the Civil Service, the head of the Foreign Office. So everyone could see that he was associating with some very unsavory characters, that he was giving away secrets that were passed to him. And indeed, later on, when he had been sent to France in 1940 to be given a job after the outbreak of war, his job was to liaise with the French First Army. Now, he became aware of the French defense plans, and he passed these to the Germans, and they were aware of this because of their surveillance. And these plans were then passed back through a man called Charles Bedeau, who was a German agent who was a friend of his, who had lent him his castle in France when he got married, and passed back to Ribbentrop in Berlin. And we know that, again, from these discovered telegrams, the Marburg file. So people were well aware of what he was up to. He even came back to Britain in the spring of 1940, ostensibly to discuss with Churchill his future, but in fact to intrigue against his own, the British government, against Chamberlain, to have some sort of peace party. He actually broadcast on the outbreak of war in 1939 a message to Hitler saying, you know, we should have peace. And even when he was sent to the Bahamas as governor, in 1940, he was still agitating with the isolationists to try and keep America out of the war.
You know, there are some who claim that what he really wanted to do was function as some kind of a peace, and you've talked about some kind of a peacemaker between the two countries, and that he was so concerned about carnage, World War One, he didn't want to see that happen again. But that was not his motivation.
No, that's been the line up till now. The line has been that he was naive, he was idealistic, and that he really just wanted to appease Germany, which of course had been British policy up to, 1938-39. But I think people were well aware of the horrors of what was going on in Germany. They realized that Hitler couldn't be appeased, I think certainly after Munich. And of course, policy changed. So it went beyond that. For example, when the Germans approached him in the summer of 40 to work for them, he didn't report those approaches to anyone. He carried on talking to them. We know that he told them that if you want to subjugate Britain, the best way to do so is to bomb Britain. And there's some suspicion that he even encouraged them to bomb Buckingham Palace, which almost killed George VI. So it was pretty ruthless stuff. And this is all based not on supposition, but on hard documented fact.
You know, so there have also been those who have said that he didn't really understand the horrors of the Nazis that they would unleash. You don't buy that.
I don't buy that at all. He toured Germany in October 1937. He saw concentration camps. He inspected SS troops. He met all the German leaders. You know, he was well briefed and warned while he was king. He still had advisors as Duke of Windsor. He could read the papers. I don't think that really stands up. People were well aware by this time. I mean, and also his country was at war with Germany. He should not have been dealing with them. He was communicating with them in code during wartime, which was a capital offense. People were being executed for far less than that.
You know, as the king, he had a private secretary. His diaries and others, they also confirm that he was a traitor.
Yes, I think one of the really important sources is the diary of a man called Alan Lascelles, who's a character in The Crown. And that's many of those diaries are still closed, but quite a few of them are open in archives. And you can chart his concerns about his charge right through the 1930s and right through into the war. And the other very important source are the diaries of a man called Guy Liddell, who in fact was Lascelles' cousin, who was a senior intelligence officer. He probably would have become the head of British intelligence, but he was caught up in the scandal of the Cambridge spy ring. But his diary, which he wasn't supposed to keep, gives us a day-by-day account of the discovery of these Marburg files, the ongoing investigations into the Duke's treachery, his associations with people. But we've also got reports done by various other intelligence organizations, both American and British, naval intelligence and others, reporting on his associations with people who were known German agents. And that was both in the Bahamas and also in Lisbon.
You know, he also engaged in some pretty illegal currency trading for an extended period, didn't he?
Yes. I mean, he was actually an extremely rich man. He had been siphoning funds from the various royal estates even before he became king. He, for example, was giving £1 million, at that time, £1 million pound jewels to Wallace. And I think everyone was really shocked when they discovered that they had to do some settlement with him, how rich he was, that it was no need for a settlement. And though throughout his life he always pleaded poverty, he was an extremely rich man. But he also was involved in currency speculation. Indeed, he was investigated by French banking authorities in the 1950s. And the whole situation was saved by basically his private secretary falling on his sword and taking the rap. But in the Bahamas, he had got involved with a German agent called Axel Wenner-Gren and a number of businessmen there, a man called Harold Christie, who was a property developer, and someone called Harry Oakes, who was probably the richest inhabitant on the Bahamas. Now, Oakes was murdered in July 1943, probably by Christie, because of being crossed in business. And it all related to investments that the men, including the Duke of Windsor, were making in a Nazi bank in Mexico, the Banco Continental. And though some of this stuff has been covered up, bits of it are beginning to emerge from various sources. And so he shut down the murder investigation because, of course, he didn't want any scrutiny of what was going on. He posted the commissioner of police, who would have been an honest cop, to Trinidad. He brought in two bent coppers from the FBI in Miami who had worked for Mayor Lansky. So all the way through his life, he was dishonest and not just a traitor.
Now, we know that he didn't want to go to the Bahamas, but a lot of people don't know that apparently he was threatened with court-martial if he didn't move.
Yes. I mean, the extraordinary thing is that this document has been in the church in Churchill's papers for years. I don't know why other historians haven't found it or used it, but it's very, very clear that Churchill was able to threaten court-martial because the Duke had taken service in the British Army. He was a major general. And of course, during war, the commander-in-chief was the prime minister. And again, I quote the document. His choice was to be court-martialed or to go to the Bahamas, and he realized that he should go to the Bahamas. But even on his way to the Bahamas, he was communicating with the Germans saying, you know, even to the Bahamas, I can come back if I'm wanted.
You know, wasn't there a Nazi plan of some kind called Operation Willy, where they were messing with him?
Yes, Operation Willy, which was spearheaded by a very bright young SS general called Walter Schellenberg, was a plan to plant him on the throne again as a puppet king for the Nazis. The great hope was, of course, you know, the Germans had swept through France in May 1940. They had pretty much defeated the British army that was trapped at Dunkirk. And if they had been able to destroy this British expeditionary force, the British army, they would have been able to invade Britain and to basically occupy it in the way they occupied France and Holland. And the idea was that they would install the Duke as their king. Churchill and the George VI would be executed or sent into exile. And this was Operation Willy, and they brought millions of Swiss francs to bribe him. He was going to wait for the right moment in Switzerland. This was all part of these negotiations in the summer of 1940, which was, of course, recorded in these Marburg files and indeed in Portuguese Secret Service files. So the line has always been in Operation Willy that he was approached. He didn't realize what was going on. And it was just people trying to big themselves up in front of Hitler. But it's very clear when you look at all the documentation that it was far more than that. He was not an innocent dupe. He was an active intriguer.
You know, the Nazis really played on his insecurities, too, didn't they? They telling him that the British Secret Service might have a plan of assassinating him?
Yes. It was interesting. The Germans were able to persuade him to do this tour in October 37, because he could show off. It was like having a royal tour. He could show off to Wallace. She would get the attention that she might have got if she'd been queen. He was very susceptible to flattery, and that's exactly what, and threats, what happened in the summer of 40. They used a carrot and stick approach. And one of the things that they did was to try and scare them. So they threw stones at his window. They claimed there was a bomb on the ship taking away, that British agents were out to kill him. In fact, there was some truth in this. A man called Peter Russell, later professor of Spanish at Oxford University, had been sent by British intelligence to keep an eye on him and to shoot him, make it appear an accident, if at any point he looked like he was going across to the Germans, or they'd managed to get him out of Portugal and on his way to Switzerland. So he had some justification for that fear. But they did all sorts of things. They intimidated people. There were delays on getting his luggage onto the ship, everything to make life difficult and want to persuade him to stay in Spain and Portugal.
Should he have been charged with treason? And I can't imagine that happening, but should he have been charged with that?
Well, as I said, people were executed for far less.
Yes.
I think there were two reasons why he wasn't charged. One was much of the evidence appeared only after the war with these Marburg files, which, of course, they played down. The other was that it would, of course, revealed the fact that he was under surveillance, that his mail was being read. And I think the main reason is this was very close. This was the former monarch. He'd only abdicated a few years earlier. It's still pretty close to the present monarchy. This is the uncle of the woman who's just died, Queen Elizabeth II. It would have been a huge scandal. And the way that the British deal with scandals is they hush them up.
You know, looking back from our time now and what we now know, it appears that Britain really was fortunate to have had such a stable, long-serving, and relatively scandal-free monarch in Elizabeth II, who clearly had a sense of public duty.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the trope in the Crown series is between public duty and private pleasure. And, you know, the royals, which I call the rogue royals, are the ones I like writing about. So people like Princess Margaret, Prince Andrew, Prince Harry are the rogue royals. And those are the ones they want to streamline out. But the dedicated royals, the Queen, Prince Philip, Prince Charles, William and Kate, Princess Anne, you know, they are all taking their lead from George VI, and in fact going back to George V, of the monarchy representing the nation, being the family of the nation. It's interesting in the funeral for Queen Elizabeth, the focus was as much on the family grieving as on the public grieving and the public ceremony. I think the experience of the Duke of Windsor deeply affected them. Prince Charles was very close to Mountbatten, who in fact had as his best man at his wedding the Duke of Windsor. They were very close. And whenever Prince Charles was petulant or self-centered or in any way behaved badly, Mountbatten would remind him of the example of the Duke of Windsor and saying, "You don't want to turn out like him." And so it's always been at the back of their mind. This is not the example you want to set. And so we were very fortunate, because it's very clear when the Duke of Windsor was not given the job after his after being governor of the Bahamas, because no one trusted him, no one felt he was up to the job. He, in fact, had done what he called the second abdication. He'd actually left the job early because he didn't like the heat and the mosquitoes in the Bahamas. But no one would give him a job. Instead of devoting his life to charity or something useful, he just went around cafe society, played golf, gardened, looked at his investments, and was a complete waste of space, really. That example is always held up to other members of the royal family as the way not to play it.
Standard bearer is the, that's the phrase that I think about when I think of Queen Elizabeth, I think King Charles. Standard bearers in terms of showing their fellow countrymen and also the rest of the world what they believe it is to be to be a strong reminder of what family is and how we should act. Is that fair to say?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, the Queen was the grandmother of the nation. Charles, now in his 70s, is the grandfather of the nation. People are drawn to them because they can relate to everyone. I think we've seen that with the grieving that's gone on. People from all walks of life have queued for 24 hours to go and pay tribute to the Queen lying in state in Westminster Hall. And it shows the depth of the strength of feeling in favor of the monarchy. Now, this is an institution that everyone thought perhaps had its time, that the, after the Queen died, Charles, who of course has had a pretty scandalous life, would be very vulnerable. And I think what they've done very cleverly during the Jubilee and again during the last week is to show that there is succession there. They've got Prince of Wales and now his son George, who's only eight, I think, or nine, as the future. And that this they are above politics, they can communicate and, in a sense, deal with people on the margins of life. And of course, they can exert soft power in this country to help the union together. The fact she died in Scotland has been utilized to bind the Scots into England, Wales and Ireland, but also the soft power that comes from dealing with other nations. And that is very, very effective. We saw it with the Queen's role in the Commonwealth and the way that they've been able to often do things behind the scenes. I'm sure it's going on this very moment with the various leaders that are in Britain for the funeral. So yeah, it's
go ahead. I'm sorry.
It's it's I think the monarchy, which people felt was probably vulnerable when she died, I think is as strong as ever.
I'm curious about that. The future of the Commonwealth. Barbados had decided that they did not want the British monarch to be the head of state, I believe. Jamaica seems to be talking about doing something similar to that. So there may be changes ahead, but not the kinds of momentous changes that people had envisioned a few years ago.
Yes. I mean, I think that there will, of course, be people who break off, particularly in the Caribbean. And I think that was even happening before the Queen died. Mm-hmm. I think the key is Canada, Australia and New Zealand. And I think we'll see a lot of focus with tours already. The King and Prince of Wales have tours scheduled for Australia. And Republican sentiment there seems to be declining. There again was huge worries about that. But I think that there will be some sort of accommodation. I think one of the problems recently was some of these visits looked like a sort of colonialism with people in white jackets and people mm-hmm. kept behind fences. And I think we'll see a much more approachable monarchy, many more walkabouts, much more informality. But there's always this balance to make between the mystique of monastery, the need to be separate and apart, and the need to also engage. And that's a very difficult line to walk. The Queen played it very, very straight. No one knew her opinion. She never gave interviews. She was always rather po-faced in public, though actually had a rather waspish sense of humor in private. But Charles is a more open, I think, figure. And we know, of course, much more about his political views. And I think William and Kate, you know, only just 40, a lot of people can identify them with as young parents. And so the monarchy will evolve as it's always evolved. And even recently, after the death of Diana, when it was seen to be remote, the Queen broadcast, they began to go out and engage with the populace. So they're very astute at picking up and running with public opinion and not being isolated and apart from it.
You know, there are some concerns. I would imagine that the talk in Scotland among many of moving away, that has to be one of the most important things that the king is currently thinking about.
Yes. And, you know, if one wasn't a cynic, one would almost say that she died. It was arranged for her to die in Scotland. People yes. knew she was ill and she went there. I mean, there are even suspicions that she's alive and in a room in Balmoral watching her own funeral. But it was very lucky she died there. It gave them a chance to begin the funeral arrangements there. Of course, the Scots can separate and still have a king, a separate king. But my own feeling as a Scot is that they will realize the strengths of the union, the strength of being together as part of four nations. The opportunities for the Scots will be greater. And the king, of course, has a title. All of the royal family have two titles, one English title and one Scottish title. So I think he's the Duke of Rothesay. Prince Edward is the Earl of Wessex and Forfar in Scotland. So they're very keen to keep that link. My own feeling is Northern Ireland is a bigger problem. We've got the debate over the Northern Ireland Protocol as a result of Brexit. And we also have Sinn Féin in power, a growing Catholic population, a declining Protestant population. I think inevitably, almost just by population change, we will see democratically a united Ireland. And that, I think, has to be, should be part of a concern to them. But it may be many, many years before that happens.
Getting back to Edward and Wallace, do you think that she ever really loved him?
No, I think that's a very good question. I think she enjoyed being the king's mistress, the jewels that were piled on her, the attention she got, the people she met. But events, in a sense, overtook her. She was very happy to have the affair and assumed it would all end, and she would stay with her husband, Ernest Simpson, who she loved in many ways and continued, in fact, to write to even after her divorce. But the king was so obsessed with having her that he, in a sense, paid off Ernest Simpson to divorce her, to act as a guilty party in the divorce. And events just overtook her, and she was frightened. She wanted to get out. And as I say, he threatened to kill himself if she did go. So she was stuck there. The music stopped just at the wrong point. And, you know, I think there's a scene the first day that of their marriage where she goes to him and she says, "Now, what do we do next?" You know, they had their life stretched out in front of them with nothing really planned. She was bored by him. He had no hinterland. He had no interest in art or music or literature. He didn't read. When someone, he heard a Mozart concert, he said, "Who wrote that? It's I'd love to hear some other music by him." He was a totally uneducated man. And so she spent her time, as I say, in these affairs, including an affair with Jimmy Donoghue, the heir to the Woolworth fortune, who was bisexual. It was said that she'd given up a king for a queen. And others, William Bullitt, the ambassador in Paris, she began an affair with months after her marriage. So she found her sort of escape elsewhere, with friends, with this wild social life, with trying to replicate the life that they had given up with liveried servants and very extensive staffs. There's a very, I think, chilling moment. Supposedly, he died in her arms in 1972. The reality is that she had a room two doors away from him. He was calling out for her for the last 2 weeks of his life, and she never once came to see him. He died in the arms of a woman called Julie Ann Chattard, temporary night nurse from Baltimore, still alive, who was brought in to nurse him. And that, I think, says it all, that even when he was calling out for her at the end of his life, she ignored those calls from two doors away.
You know, if people who read the book, there is no way to walk away from it without realizing that what you've come up with is an individual who is pretty emotionally weak, really stunted. You write about how he writes to his girlfriends in baby talk.
Yes, I mean he was physically stunted. He had mumps as a young boy. It was said that he had no body hair whatsoever. He only shaved a couple of times a week. But he was emotionally very immature. All the women, his mistresses before he met Wallace, were older married women who were mother figures to him. The mother that he'd never really had, because Queen Mary was so remote. We now know about this baby talk because some of the letters to these mistresses were found by the families and published. He behaved like a sort of 10-year-old. When he was drunk, he would break into German and conduct fake orchestras. He was a great stickler for ceremony. So when he left to go for the bathroom, instead of doing it discreetly, he actually insisted everyone stand up for him when he left and came back. There's a wonderful story from Rex Harrison trying to kill him, taking him back from dinner up above Portofino in an open Jeep without seatbelts and swerving deliberately at all the bends in the hope that he could dislodge the former king. No one liked him. He was mean. He never picked up a bill. He was boring. He constantly harped back to his time as king. And he really had no small talk whatsoever.
He never should have been king. Obviously, because of who he was and how he was born. He was, but if people were selecting, he never would have been the king.
No, well, that's the problem with monarchy, that, you know, you do get these people thrown up. But I think what's so clever is that the British system somehow manages to dislodge them, find some reason to move them away from any power or to neutralize them. So we've ended up with some pretty good kings in the last, you know, since Victoria. You know, several of them, of course, the firstborn have died. The brother of George V was an epileptic. And so somehow the system works. And, you know, of course, Charles has streamlined the rogue royals like Prince Andrew, who at one point was second in line to the throne, and ensured that the people who, in a sense, are facing the public have a very good public persona.
You know, documents concerning the royal family, I believe that they don't have to be released for something like 100 years. Normally it's 30 years with documents, but is that correct?
No, I'm afraid it's worse than that. But the fact is that there's one of the exemptions, Section 37, relates to the sovereign and the immediate family. And it means that nothing relating to the royal family can be released. So, for example, papers relating to Queen Victoria are still closed. But there is this extraordinary deference to the royal family. And this is meant, of course, to protect their reputation.
Historian and author Andrew Lowney's latest book is Traitor King, The Scandalous Exile of the Duke and Duchess of Windsor. Andrew, thanks for being with us today. What an education, goodness.
It's been a pleasure.
You can follow us on Twitter at KERA Think. Use any podcast app to get the Think podcast, or go to our website, think.kera.org. Once again, I'm John McKay, in for Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.